When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Since 1983, Eddie Trunk has been the voice for fans of rock, hard rock, and heavy metal. A best-selling author, host of TV's That Metal Show, and seven national radio shows, including Trunk Nation, daily on Sirius XM.
Interesting.
Eddie offers the world his news-making interviews, passionate analysis, honest commentary, and who knows what else. So welcome to the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Hey folks, Eddie Trunk here, and welcome to another episode of the Eddie Trunk Podcast. Every Thursday, new episodes, Podcast One, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening around the world and checking out the Eddie Trunk Podcast. It is greatly appreciated, bringing you all sorts of great rock talk, interview, conversation, analysis, etc. Each and every week. And interview this week is going to be a fun one and an interesting one. And as always, all the interviews you hear on my podcast originate on my Sirius XM radio show, which is called Trunk Nation and heard Monday through Friday live 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on Volume Channel 106 with nightly replays 10 to midnight Eastern and full shows, audio, video, and more anytime you want on the Sirius XM app. If you're listening to just the podcast, you are getting just a tiny, tiny taste of what I do on a daily basis on the radio. So hope you come on board and join me each and every day on Sirius XM Volume for Trunk Nation. There's also a sixth show on Mondays, 5 to 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and that is heard on Channel 39, Hair Nation. You got the FM terrestrial radio show on more than 30 radio stations across the country, bringing in a lot of great hard rock and metal music, and of course this podcast, making 8 broadcasts a week for you to check out, and I thank you for connecting and doing so. Don't forget about social media at Eddie Trunk, Twitter, fan page on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, where I would be the most active as far as info and updates. And I think that kind of covers a cameo too. If you're interested in a cameo video, I just did a nice birthday video for somebody. I appreciate those orders. And if you are interested in cameo, just search for my profile at cameo.com. Just a quick note, you cannot book cameos for me any longer through the app on an Apple device. Apple was charging a tremendous amount of money for a percentage to do it that way. So if you want to book on Cameo, go to cameo.com directly on the website and do it. Or if you're on an Android, you can go ahead and do it there via the app. All right, so the interview this week is with an author by the name of Doug Broad, who wrote a fantastic book called They All Just... I always screw up the title. Hold on a second. Hold on. The book is right here. Hold on. Hold on. Hold on. Even though it's a lyric in a Cheap Trick song, Surrender, I always just get it wrong. Let me give you the full title of the book. They Just Seem a Little Weird, How Kiss, Cheap Trick, Aerosmith, and Stars Remade Rock and Roll. Now, a couple years ago, Doug, the author who wrote this book, contacted me and asked if he could ask me some questions for the book and interview me for it, which I did. And at that time, I said to him, look, I love all four of these bands, but Stars? Nobody knows who Stars is. And he said, yeah, but they're important to me. And I thought it was incredibly cool that he was including them in that in that sentence and with those other three bands. But again, in all honesty, they're a band that unfortunately just never made it. So people are trying to figure out how they fit into the picture. And a lot of this book, Doug talks about, in his view, why they fit into the picture, despite their lack of commercial success and mainstream awareness. He feels that they are a viable addition because all four of these bands are connected. And throughout the book, he tries to make that connection. It's a fascinating read. I got to tell you, the book is fantastic. If you are a fan of 70s-based hard rock music, the book is great. And if you don't know who Stars is, which is the only band of the four that obviously is not a household name, you'll learn about them in this book, and it may even inspire you to go out and check out their music. Which I've known Stars guitarist Richie Rano for 40 years almost. He's a New Jersey guy like me, and I've known him and seen him and back when he put on Kiss conventions. I know Richie to this day. And in the conversation you're about to hear, Richie actually joins us in the last segment. He was listening, and he called in, and I put him on the air. So he jumps in towards the end of the conversation with Doug about this book. And at the time I did this interview a couple weeks ago, I had not completely finished the book. I read about 80% of it. Now, at the time I'm recording the open to this podcast, I did finish off the book. And again, it is a great read. So I cannot recommend it more highly if you're looking for a great book, if you're a fan of 70s hard rock, if you're a fan of any of these four bands, or like me, a fan of all four of them, you'll be very entertained by this book. You can't go wrong with it. I'll tell you, I've got a ton of books stacked up here, and many of them, it's very hard to make the time commitment to read. But this one, I actually carved out an hour at the end of my day every day to sit down and read some of it because it was that good. So I think you'll enjoy it. The conversation with Doug is quite long and quite wide-ranging about these four bands, among others. And even with the time we had, there was still so much more that I would have gotten to or like to have gotten to about these groups in this period of time in rock history. So without further ado, since it is one of the longer interviews I've done in a while, we're going to get to it right now. Coming up, as a matter of fact, here on the Eddie Trunk Podcast, Doug Broad, author of the book, They Just Seem a Little Weird, a book about Kiss, Stars, Aerosmith, and Cheap Trick. And we'll have a conversation with him about it coming up next.
The Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Hey folks, are you paying out of your own pocket for gear you need to do your job? All kinds of departments across the nation, all those good folks, police, fire, EMS, medical workers on the front lines, even military units. You deal with constrained budgets, outdated gear, but there's still a job to do and you need the right gear to do it. Hunting for military first responder discounts has historically required going from one website to another, creating multiple account logins just to make purchases, and jumping through various hoops to verify your service. Don't you wish there was just one place where you could visit that had a carefully crafted selection of deals for military first responders in one spot? Well, folks, we got that answer for you because it is the place to go, and that place is, no doubt about it, what I'm about to tell you about, and that is GovX.com. GovX works directly with brands to negotiate the best price possible because you deserve the gear you need at the prices you've earned. Plus, you can trust that the gear you're ordering is 100% authentic, direct from the manufacturers. Big general retailers, they don't care about you and your sacrifices as long as you're clicking on the add to the cart button. Not GovX. Got a huge collection of gear and apparel from popular brands all in one convenient location. GovX honors your service and gives back to your communities. So if you're an American of service, a current or former member of the military, firefighters, frontline medical or law enforcement communities, or the emergency medical communities, join GovX for free and enjoy a community that honors and gives back to patriots like you. And if you got a military or a first responder background, you visit GovX.com, you sign up for free for instant access to tons of deals and a community that honors your service. And check this out. Use the promo code TRUNK15, T-R-U-N-K 15. You get $15 off your first order of $50 or more. That's an amazing deal. Just use my code TRUNK, T-R-U-N-K 15. GovX.com, GovX.com.
From the team that brought you the big podcast with Shaq, it's the Big Shot Bob Pod with the biggest shooter in NBA history, Robert Horry.
To Horry for three. Oh, unbelievable. Bob.
This guy is off the charts.
The Big Shot Bob Pod. Yeah, of course we're talking about hoops. Charles Oakley.
We played him in the finals, losing to Rockets, and I dunked on Oak, and I kind of flexed on like, And Oak didn't do anything. I went down the court like this. I just missed a punch to the jaw there, boy.
The Big Shot Bob Pod is coming your way soon on the Podcast One app, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, livebylive.com, and everywhere you get your favorite podcasts.
This is the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Eddie Trunk here with you on this week's Eddie Trunk Podcast. All right, I set it up at the top. Author Doug Broad is my guest, talking about his great book, They Just Seem a Little Weird. Here is Doug. Enjoy the conversation. Welcome, Doug. How are you, man?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm good. I guess, you know, the last time and only time we ever spoke before was when you actually talked to me a little bit for this book, which was, I guess, when did you start writing it? Was it a couple of years ago?
A couple of years ago, yeah. Since then, I interviewed around 136 people for the book, and it finally came out last month, and it's getting some good reaction.
You know, I'll tell you, I was saying to my audience, the challenge with getting books for me is doing this is and doing interviews is. I love to interview authors about books after I've had a chance to read the book. And needless to say, reading a book is time consuming. So I don't always get a chance to do that. With your book, I really put the pedal to the metal and I am about 85% through with it. I'm almost there, but I got to tell you, Doug, and I'm not just saying this because you're on the air with me. It was just finding the time. It wasn't that I ever wanted to put it down. It's a fantastic read, a tremendous job on this. I really, really enjoyed it.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. And one thing is, you know, the chapters are kind of short, so it is kind of a breeze to read.
Yeah, it really is. And I've recommended it to all my friends who are around my age that, that grew up with these bands and grew up loving these bands. Before we get into specifics on the book, what a little bit of your background, Doug. You were an editor and a writer in the past, right?
Yeah, I've been a writer and editor for a long time, mostly magazine editor. I worked for 11 years at Entertainment Weekly. I was the editor-in-chief of Spin Magazine for 6 years, and I was at TV Guide for a while as well. So I've been a magazine editor pretty much all my life, and I've also written a lot about music for The Village Voice, for Trouser Press Record Guide, for Classic Rock Magazine, and many other places.
Were you at Spin when Spin did the four individual Kiss covers for the reunion?
That was before my time. No, I was there during the days of the Strokes and the Yeah, Yeah, Yeahs, pretty much the early 2000s.
Okay, and where did you grow up, Doug?
I grew up in Brooklyn and Queens, in New York. So,
all right. So You're a New York local guy. So the reason why I'm bringing that up, and I believe you're around my age, I'm 56. So you're in that area as well.
I am. Yes.
The reason why I'm asking this is because that's all important for context when we talk about the bands you've written about in these books, because in your book, because obviously you would have grown up with them in the same way that I did. So tell me the idea that you had to do this book, because as I mentioned to you when you first talked to me about this, and in all honesty, I've been, you know, since I've been promoting the book and you coming on, Stars is the one band that I need to explain to people who they are, because they are very much the outlier in all of this, in the sense that not that they weren't a great band, but they were not commercially successful. So tell me about putting this book together, the concept behind it, and why these four bands.
That's a great question. So, you know, I always wanted to write a book about Kiss and Cheap Trick, who are always two of my favorite bands. And, you know, they were very connected in the 70s. They toured together. You know, the bands have been friends forever. And I figured I'd tell the story of 70s rock through the eyes of Kiss and Cheap Trick. And when I looked at Gene's solo album from 78, he had not only Rick Nielsen playing on it, but he also had Joe Perry from Aerosmith, and he had Richie Rano from Stars. And I figured, you know, that'd be a great way to tell the story of 70s rock through the eyes of these four bands that were very interconnected. I mean, you're right, Stars is kind of the outlier. They're kind of a wild card. You know, they had many of the same opportunities as these other bands. They had four albums on Capitol. They were managed by Bill O'Coin, who was Kiss's manager. They toured a lot with Aerosmith. Jack Douglas, who produced Aerosmith and Cheap Trick, also produced Stars. And so I wanted to explore why a band like Stars never really made it, despite having many of the same opportunities. And I figured I can tell that story, you know, as a band connected with these other three bands.
Now, when you say that, and I, again, I'm not saying this in any way to be disparaging of Stars, who I am a fan of, who, you know, I know Richie, who's a friend for years. I've seen the band in recent years. Michael Lee Smith can still sing incredibly well. Great songs. A band that people who do know them were very influenced by them. So I don't mean this in any way to be disparaging about Stars, but I'm assuming that you are a fan, because you could easily say some of the things you said. Well, beyond the Gene Simmons things, like for instance, I was a huge fan of Piper, which was technically the first band I ever saw live, because I saw them open for Kiss, and they were managed by O'Coin. They had a couple records. Sean Delaney produced their second record. So you can connect some of these dots with other bands of that time. It sounds to me also, be above and beyond all that, were you a Stars fan? Did you go see them back in the day?
Actually, I did not, and I only became a Stars fan when they re-released their material on CD through Rykodisc, I think in around 2004-2005. You know, I always knew about them from reading Cream magazine and Circus magazine and seeing their ads and their, you know, they had a great logo, but I never really investigated. And by the time, you know, in 78, 79, 80, I kind of moved on to punk rock and new wave. So they kind of fell away, but then, you know, I heard them and I love their records when I first heard them. And, you know, that's kind of how they made the imprint on me. And I hear what you're saying about a band like Piper. You know, people have said, oh, what about Ted Nugent? He had some connections, but frankly, I mean, I really love Stars, and you know, the connections ran so deep as I did more digging. I mean, they had connections with Cheap Trick's manager even before he was managing Cheap Trick back in Wisconsin. So there's a lot of history there that's never really been, you know, uncovered. And hopefully in the book, I was able to do that.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about all four of these bands with the book as well. But, you know, what's interesting, and I'm curious, is the you including a band like Stars with three other bands that are honestly with rock fans are all household names, but you including them in that grouping, have you felt like it's caused people to seek them out a little bit, to have renewed interest in them, to ask questions like, wait, who is that band, and let's find out about them? Are you picking up on that in other interviews and people you're talking to since the book has been out?
Absolutely. It's funny because a lot of people are contacting me through Facebook and Twitter and saying how much they like the book and appreciating that I turned them on to Starz. They never heard about Starz before. At the same time, with some of the other interviews that I've been doing for terrestrial radio, with a lot of these guys who are old-timers and even older than us who have been around forever, they're all asking about Starz. They remember Starz. They're like, whatever happened to Starz? So at the same time, people are asking me, you know, or who are telling me they're appreciating the fact that I kind of brought Starz out again and they like them. At the same time, a lot of the old-timers are saying, wow, good for you for talking about Starz again. So it's a great feeling.
Yeah, you know, I when I was doing my TV show, That Metal Show, we used to always wear different band shirts on every episode, and I one day wore a Starz shirt, and we did a ironically, that day that we did that taping that I wore the shirt in was also the day the network decided they wanted to do some new photos of us. So in a lot of the promo photos of that season, I'm wearing the same thing, the Starz shirt. And not long after that all aired, I went to see Starz at a club in New Jersey, and Michael Lee Smith came up to me and he said, I just want to thank you for wearing our shirt on TV. He goes, because in that 1 hour of television, he said, you probably brought more attention and promotion to the band than in 4 albums on Capitol. And I was like, man, that's really sad. But in a way, you know, when you know the story, unfortunately, it's not a unique story. There's a lot of bands that have had, you know, fall between the cracks like that.
Absolutely, yeah. No, and those guys, they all have a sense of humor. They get it, and, you know, I think what Michael said was probably, it was obviously exaggerating, but it's funny he would say that.
Yeah, no doubt. Of these 4 bands, Doug, who is your personal favorite, and who have you seen the most, and what's the one that was like the gateway for you?
Well, the gateway for me was Kiss. You know, I saw them in 74 or 75 on TV on the Mike Douglas Show, and, you know, I was 10 years old and I just totally fell in love with them. I was a big, like, horror, sci-fi, fantasy geek, and they just played to that for me. They look cool. The songs were just cool and fun and simple. So I was like all in with Kiss for a bunch of years. And then I discovered Cheap Trick when that first album came out, and that, you know, they became my favorite band of all time. And I've seen them probably around 50 times. I pretty much saw them, like every time they played New York. I missed a couple of times, but I try to see them whenever they played New York.
How much cooperation did you get from these 4 bands in making this book, if any?
I didn't get any cooperation from Aerosmith. They declined to be interviewed for whatever reason. With Kiss, I spoke with Paul Stanley for a number of hours. He was the only one who participated. I had spoken to Gene around 10 years ago for a piece I did for Spin magazine, and I had a lot of outtakes that were germane to this story, so I was able to use some quotes from that, you know, from that interview. With Cheap Trick, I spoke to Bunny Carlos at length. I went to Illinois to speak with him in his drum barn, spent a day with him up there. I spoke to Rick Nielsen for the book. Neither Robin nor Tom Peterson wanted to talk for the book for whatever reason. And then with Starz, I got all the guys in the band. So, I got a lot of cooperation.
Yeah, I'm at the point now when you talk about Cheap Trick. So where I'm left off on the book, and I can tell you because I got it right in front of me with a marker in it, I'm about to start chapter 25, which is titled Surrender. So I'm at page 237 right now. So I just read in the book the whole thing about, and it's interesting bringing the Starz thing back into it. One of the reasons and ways I know Richie for decades is because when he was doing – those KISS conventions, often I would either appear at them or, you know, sometimes I went there with Ace because I was working with him at the time. So I know him from, you know, from back in those days. That's how long we go back. But I'm curious, when it comes to Cheap Trick, do you get, since Bunny Carlos was your guy, and clearly he's the one guy not in the band anymore, do you get into, in the book, his departure from the band and the circumstances surrounding it?
Not too much, actually, only because, you know, the book pretty much takes place in the 70s and 80s, and he was gone much later, so I didn't think his departure really merited much because it didn't really tie into the thread of the story as much as, say, Tom Peterson's departure did, or Joe Perry's, or Peter's, or Ace's did, because those all happened pretty much during the, you know, the heyday of those bands. So I didn't feel the need to get into it, and it's you know, it's been talked about in the press already, and Rolling Stone has had the back and forth between Bunny and the band, and I just didn't really, I had to stop somewhere, so I didn't feel the need to get too deep into it.
Yeah, now the reason why I ask is because you talk about it's been out there a little bit, but I don't know. I mean, I know in the case of this book, I know all of these guys. One of them won't talk to me. That's Paul Stanley. But outside of that, and because Paul won't talk to me, the rest of the band can't. But outside of that, the other guys, the Aerosmith guys, I've spent time with, Cheap Trick guys, great friends, you know, Richie and Michael, the Stars guys. So I know all of these guys. But with Cheap Trick, it's funny because I don't know Bun. I've never really talked to Bunny, but the other guys, I never really got a straight answer on what happened there. And a lot of times when I've asked them on the record, they'd say things like, well, he's still in the band. He just doesn't tour with us anymore. So it was always like a clouded thing to me, at least. And I just never got a real defined answer on it.
Yeah. You know, and that's the one thing about Cheap Trick, I think, compared to these other bands, there's not a lot out there about their, you know, their personal lives. There's not a lot of dirt out there on Cheap Trick for whatever reason. And, you know, in the case of Bunny, you know, he's been very blunt about his reasons for leaving the band. And then the band also has been blunt about why they think he's gone as well. And from what I understand, you know, he does, you know, retain interest in the band. So he is kind of he is still a member, but not touring. He's still part of the Cheap Trick organization, although he doesn't really have anything to do with the, you know, the day-to-day touring and recording of it.
Let's talk for a second about clearly the two biggest bands in the book, and that would be KISS and Aerosmith. And that is still the case now. I mean, you can talk about that being the case in the 70s, but still
sure,
also the case now. What's interesting about this, and you touch on this, is there really was a rivalry between those two bands from day one, wasn't there?
There was. You know, 1974, both bands were pretty much just starting out, and they did two shows together. You know, Aerosmith had two albums. They had just released Get Your Wings. KISS had one album, their debut, and they had just started playing outside of New York. They did a show in Ohio, and then they did a show in Detroit a few weeks apart. And, you know, KISS had these outrageous demands for an opening band. They had their show. It was a rudimentary show. It wasn't what you see now, obviously, but it still was something. And, you know, that intimidated a lot of other bands. They didn't want these explosions and, you know, big lighted logos and drum risers and all of this stuff. And, you know, at some point, you know, the road crews, the Aerosmith and KISS road crews at these shows got into some confrontations. In fact, at one of them, a knife was drawn, or a couple of knives were drawn. So there was a lot of animosity there, at least between the road crews. And, you know, Steven Tyler never really got Kiss or liked Kiss, and I think, you know, the potential violence at those shows really turned him off, and he never really wanted to have anything to do with the band. Joe Perry, however, appreciated the music a little bit, but he actually, you know, he was kind of in awe of the show and in awe and intimidated. He did not want to have to follow something like that. In fact, he famously, you know, freaked out after one of those shows and said, you know, we have to dress up like clowns now to get noticed. And, you know, that he warmed up to Kiss, though, and they, you know, he became friendly with them, and obviously he plays on Gene's record. But then later on, when they started touring together, you know, the old animosities came up again. And you know, we all know what happened when Steven started trash-talking Kiss on the radio and Paul sort of gave as good as he got. You know, and so that has still been, that's been going on for quite a while.
Yeah, I don't know if you saw the fairly legendary now, very quickly legendary among Kiss circles, during this quarantine, you know, everybody on the planet is doing these online interviews and YouTube channels and podcasts and whatever. Did you see Richard Marx interviewing Paul Stanley?
I did not.
Oh, you got to pull it up and watch this.
You
want to talk about the you want to talk about the rivalry and animosity. Richard Marx, the singer-songwriter, is doing some YouTube show and he's got Paul on as his guest and it's on video and they're having this like nice conversation and talking about all these bands they love, and then Richard Marx does this huge build up where he goes, "All right, look, Paul, I got to talk to you about a guy who, I mean, is a total freak. I mean, no matter what, how much time goes by, he's still the best front man and singer we have. I mean, he's a complete marvel. This guy is unbelievable. Let's talk about Steven Tyler." And you can see the blood just pour out of Paul's face. It is the most awkward moment. Paul doesn't say anything for a minute. Richard Marx goes, "Did I say something wrong?" And Paul Stanley's response is, "Let's talk about Rod Stewart." It's like, he won't even acknowledge Steven Tyler exists. And by the way, I agree with Richard Marx. I mean, we have in these bands, you have two people that are absolutely ageless in the fact of their abilities as singers and frontman, and that would be Tyler and Robin Zander, who is also still ridiculous. So it's amazing how some of these guys have held up. You know, Paul Stanley physically is still in great shape, but we don't know what's going on vocally. But in terms of just being able to sing in front of band, when I go see either Aerosmith or Cheap Trick to this day, it puts me back in 78, 77, because both of them still look and sound that good. It's remarkable.
Absolutely. And that's one of the great things about, in fact, all four of these bands, you know, up until the pandemic struck, they were all out playing. I mean, Stars were about to go on tour with Angel. You know, Kiss were in the midst of their farewell shows. Aerosmith were doing their Las Vegas residency. And Cheap Trick are always touring. And they're about to go out with Rod Stewart. So, you know, these guys are all around 70 years old. And they're still, you know, they still look great on stage and they sound great.
In another similarity between Kiss and Aerosmith when they first started and whatever rivalries existed or what have you, was the fact that both bands were told at that time that they, very early on, and even on their first few records, it was questioned whether they could actually play and whether it was actually them playing on the records. I mean, that was another line between the two bands.
Yeah, it was. You know, I think those questions have, they're kind of moot now. I don't think they even matter. I mean, the Kiss stuff always sounded pretty easy to play, and that's something that a lot of people I interviewed for the book, a lot of the artists that came later, you know, in the 80s and 90s, a lot of them told me that Kiss were their first band because it made them want to be rock stars. Their stuff was so easy to play, so direct. You didn't have to be Steve Vai or Joe Satriani, you know, this fleet-fingered marvel. You could actually just play Kiss songs pretty straightforwardly, and I think that's one of the beauties of that band.
Yeah, and of course, both Kiss and Aerosmith in their career have had to use and have used ghost musicians. Kiss probably way more than Aerosmith, but Aerosmith famously on the second record, I heard an interview recently with Jack Douglas who admitted that on a couple of the tracks, he brought in, I think it was Dick Wagner, some people to play on Get Your Wings. And when Jack Douglas was asked why, he just said that they just weren't ready to hit the bar he needed them to hit at that point. You spoke to Jack, who looms large in all of this story, didn't you? I mean, I know you did. I read the book, but Jack brought a lot to the table here, right?
Well, actually, it's funny. I didn't speak to Jack for the book, although I was able to get a lot of research on him, and I found a lot of interviews with him and was able to use a lot of that stuff. I had actually approached Jack a couple of times, personally, and then also through various mutual acquaintances, and he declined to be interviewed for the book, although, you know, he does a lot of interviews on YouTube and for various publications. So for some reason he didn't want to participate, he looms really large in this story, because, you know, he was responsible for, you know, Aerosmith's best records, for, you know, two of Cheap Trick's finest records, for two of Stars' records. So he was a big part of this story.
I felt like you talked to Jack just because he's referenced, I guess, so much in the book. But my memory, Doug, did Jack ever, I know he never produced a Kiss record, but what didn't I read he was approached or there was discussion about it at one point?
Yes. Yeah, so after Kiss made Destroyer with Bob Ezrin, they were skittish about it. I mean, right now it's looked upon as a classic, but back then it really took Kiss out of their comfort zone with all the orchestrations and the boys choir and the calliopes and various other, you know, filigrees on that record. So what Bill O'Coin did was, for their next record, which they end up getting Eddie Kramer for, he actually approached Jack Douglas to see if he would produce the next Kiss record. And Jack was actually doing a lot of stuff with Aerosmith at the time, so he couldn't do it. But Bob Ezrin was very vocal about feeling betrayed that O'Coin would not go back to Ezrin or even mention to Ezrin that he was going to Jack, who was kind of like a protege to Bob Ezrin. So he does figure in that story a bit, but Douglas never had anything to do with Kiss after that one little scandal.
Yeah, I think it's hard for people to understand and to realize that Destroyer was such a polarizing record at the time, because it's looked at as by many, the definitive Kiss studio record, when in reality, it was at the time really polarizing and something that they felt at the time they almost needed to recover from, which is why they went in and did a really stripped down, almost live sounding record with Rock and Roll Over. But now Destroyer's looked at as this iconic record, but then, even though it was successful, it really was polarizing to the fan base.
Yeah, and it's funny, you know, you think about that record and, you know, Beth was the hit, and Beth was the song that, you know, kind of made, in a way, made Kiss's pop career. But you think about that record, and Peter Criss is the only one from the band who's on that single. It's like none of the other guys play on that record, which is kind of bizarre when you think about it.
Yeah, no doubt. Now, as much as you spend time in the 70s, heyday for all these bands, Doug, you do, and I was glad to see this, you do also venture into the 80s and also deal with some of the offshoot projects from these bands, whether in the case of Aerosmith, Joe Perry Project, or Whitford St. Holmes. I mean, with Kiss, you even get as deep into doing a big section on what Sean Delaney did with the Scat Brothers and all of that. I thought that was a really interesting thing, because I love deep stuff like that. And I know many of those records and songs, and I'm always very fascinated I'm super fascinated with these bands and the way they achieve the success, but sometimes I'm almost equally fascinated when it begins to unravel and all this the offshoot stuff. And I was really glad you included that in there as well.
Well, thanks. Yeah, it's for me as a researcher and writer, I mean, I took so much pleasure in getting the Stars story. So, you know, Stars came from the band Looking Glass, who had a hit with Brandy, You're a Fine Girl in 1972. And Richie Rano came from Stories, who had a hit with Brother Louie. And from Stars, Peter Sweevil, who was the bass player, when he left the band, he started in with Sean Delaney in Scat Brothers, which was a rock disco band. And, you know, I had never really heard of them until I was researching this book, and I really went in deep with them. And they have two records that are just kind of totally out there, outrageous. And it was just a fun story to report out. And I think I have stuff that no one else has ever gotten.
Yeah, it's fascinating. You know, and you talk about Stars and those guys having come from having had some history with other groups. That's something they tried to suppress when they came out as a, you know, harder rock act, because I went, you know, reading your book, and even though I know and love all these bands, it still inspired me to go on YouTube and find some things. And I found a TV interview with Stars from like 77. Where they ask, the interviewer asks them, so what were you guys doing before Stars? And they all put their heads down and say, we don't talk about that.
Well, yeah, Richie Rano told me that, you know, one of the things when they started Stars and they started playing out, it's like he said, if people know, if our fans know that we came from these kind of wimpy pop bands, you know, we kind of lose some credibility. So I think it was a very conscious decision not to remark on their histories. So, you know, that was kind of what they went for. And Stars had a very unique beginning because they didn't come up from the clubs. I mean, they were an O'Coin band. You know, he had Kiss. Kiss gave him a lot of leverage. So right away, Stars were playing, you know, theaters opening for Peter Frampton and ZZ Top, and then playing arenas opening for Aerosmith and Ted Nugent. So they were always an arena band. They were never a club band.
Speaking of opening, I'd love to get your take on this. So Cheap Trick had obviously a huge period, 77, 78, 79, Budokan, Dream Police period, where they reached the point where in most parts of the country they could be a full-fledged arena headliner. But it was a very, very brief moment, and before and ever since, Cheap Trick are the perennial opening act, co-headline, state theater, community theater touring band. And to their credit, those guys can play with anybody on any bill, the biggest festival or the smallest club, and they're always happy to do their thing, and they do it so well. But why do you think they slotted in like that? When you think about Cheap Trick, I mean, there are two songs that get played all the time on the radio. There's probably 10 songs that are fairly well known. But why do you think they didn't ascend to the heights of where Kiss and Aerosmith still live, being that big draw, that festival headliner, the arena headliner? Why do you think they occupy that space versus bigger?
Well, I think a lot of, for Cheap Trick, I think a lot of it comes down to momentum. I mean, I saw them for the first time when they headlined The Garden in 1980. The Romantics were opening, and that was right after Dream Police had come out, and very soon after that, Tom Petersen left the band. And, you know, losing a main member of the band like that at their height is a tough thing for a band to recover from. And the next year they came around to New York, they were playing Radio City. So they went from playing a 16,000-seat arena to a 6,000 capacity theater within a year. So, you know, I don't think they ever recovered. And they had a string of albums in the 80s that, you know, we're, I think we're great as a fan, but, you know, they didn't have a lot of hits during that period. When they actually did recover and had a, they had a big hit with the Flame in the late 80s, they were still an opening band, and that was their only number one song. And I saw them open for Robert Plant at the Garden during that period. So they never really recovered and became an arena headliner again. It's a very interesting question.
Yeah, and I mean, again, even to this day, about 7-8 years ago, I did a tour. I hosted a handful of shows through the Midwest with Aerosmith, with Cheap Trick opening. I spent a lot of time with those guys, traveled with them. I mean, they were very content to go on, do their hour set before Aerosmith. And this is like 7-8 years ago. So it's just like, mm-hmm. you know, they've always occupied that space. They didn't have the spectacular unraveling or anything that both Kiss and Aerosmith had. If you think, you know, Aerosmith probably the one band in all of this that was the most drug addled. I mean, that would be fair to say, right? They're the ones where drugs played the hugest issue by far.
Yeah, there's no doubt. And you know, that also in the case of Aerosmith led to a lot of inconsistent shows. But you can say this for Kiss and Cheap Trick. It's kind of hard to see either of those bands do a bad show. But I've seen Cheap Trick 50 times. I've never seen them do a bad show. So there's something about the consistency, the quality of the bands. But you're right. Aerosmith were the ones that were probably the most troubled.
Yeah, and I saw Aerosmith without Perry and Whitford. As a matter of fact, that was the first time I saw them. Rockin' a Hard Place, which I think is a really underrated record. And it's interesting because people make this comment about Aerosmith a lot, which I've never done drugs. I don't condone drugs in any way, but there are people that'll say they were the best when they were on drugs. Well, maybe creatively making Rocks and Draw the Line and Toys in the Attic, but definitely not live, because if you've seen the videos, they were, you know, they were at times a mess, like you said. But there's also, and again, not condoning drugs in any way, but I'll tell you what, Doug, when you're in this day and age of so many bands, and I know for a fact Aerosmith does not do this, but and neither does Cheap Trick, but in this day and age of so many bands using electronics and autocorrect and vocal tracks and all this nonsense, which I despise, it's actually kind of refreshing to see a real live band that can slip up and have a bit of a train wreck. I saw Aerosmith in Vegas on their residency recently, about a year or two ago, before it ended. And I went two or three nights in a row, and they had a bad show the night I went. And it wasn't because they were, you know, high or anything. They just didn't click. And it was wonderful in its recklessness. It was like, in its imperfection, it was absolutely brilliant, because that's what a real live rock and roll show is. And at the end of the night, Steven Tyler says to the audience, with Joe Perry standing next to him, he goes, "Man, Joe, that was a rough one. We sort of, you know, fucked up a lot, didn't we?" And Joe just nods his head. And then Tyler turns to the audience and goes, "But you guys just saw a real live rock and roll show. Did you have fun?" And the crowd went nuts. And there is that element that I do miss a lot about some of today's music, where everything has got to be so dialed in, you don't even really know what you're hearing. And I think that recklessness, which of course was probably an imprint that Aerosmith put on Guns N' Roses, who were heroes to Aerosmith, is a big it was a big thing. I think that's something that's a little bit missing with some of the newer bands today.
Well, I totally hear you on that, and it's funny because I saw Cheap Trick a few years ago at Westbury Theater, and it was a similar show. I mean, it wasn't a bad show by any means, but it was a very loose show for them. And at one point, they did a song that they hadn't done in a very, very long time, and Robin had to pull out a cheat sheet, and he didn't have his glasses, so we actually stopped the show to ask someone in the audience if they had reading glasses he could borrow, and they passed the glasses up to him, and he was able to do the song by, you know, using someone's glasses from the audience. And it was just such a wonderful human moment that it kind of broke the continuity of a rock and roll show, but you didn't mind. It was just lovely to see that.
Yeah, when I was on that run with Aerosmith and Cheap Trick, I would always bust Rick's balls and say, you got to play this tonight, you got to play that tonight. And he would always say to me, we only got an hour, man. We got an hour. And every once in a while, they'd put a song in. And then I'll never forget this. He said to me, look, come to one of our headline shows and you write the set list and we'll play it. And I was just like, yeah, right. The night before the show, it was in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. It was, it was probably 8 years ago. I get an email from Carla, their tour manager, and she says, Rick wants the set list for tomorrow night. I said, don't make me do this. I know he's not going to play the stuff I'm going to write. I'm going to put Speak Now on there. I'm going to put Downed on there. I'm going to put... No, he wants it. So I hammer out 20 songs. I email it to her. Next day, I show up at the gig. Doug, they played every song. And I was stunned because I said to them, how did you learn this stuff in time to do it? And they said, learn. We've never rehearsed in our life. And I was like, that is amazing. And of course, I didn't have one hit on my list. And it was a casino crowd. So the crowd was getting really restless when they weren't hearing, I Want You to Want Me. And then, of course, Rick outs me from the stage to the crowd and says, if you don't like what we're playing tonight, blame our friend Eddie Trunk. He picked every song. My wife wanted to die sitting next to me. And then they came out, and for the encores, they did all the hits, which sent everybody home happy. But they're such a unique band in that way. It's not like, well, we don't have time to rehearse it. We don't have time to do the tuning or load the tracks in or all this other nonsense. They'll just bang it out. If you make a request, they may actually play it.
Well, that's funny because Cheap Trick played Joe Perry's 50th birthday party, and it's a story I tell in the book. And for the party, Rick told Joe to give him a set list. So Joe wrote the set list, gave it to the band, and just like you said, when they were playing, Rick said, if you don't like the set list, blame Joe. He wrote it. So, that's kind of something that he does. But, God bless him that, they've got tons of records and they still know every song.
Yeah, and of course Dax plays in the band now, because that's what I was saying too. At that time, Dax was in, and I'm like, how's your kid going to know all this stuff? Because he knows the catalog better than we do. And son of a gun, they played it all, and they played it amazingly well. It was so great. You really tie a lot of different things together. The people these bands influenced, the offshoot bands. It really is so encompassing of this whole time. And I just love that you were able to do all that. Who were some of your favorite people to talk to for the book, Doug?
Spoke to a lot of guys from, the hair metal and grunge days. And some of the best were, like, Sebastian Bach had a lot to say, Butch Walker, Gilby Clark was great, and Kim Thayil from Soundgarden I had on the phone for, 3 hours. And he was just the most – he was a huge fan of this music, and he's so articulate about – what he liked about them and how much they influenced and drove his career.
Yeah. Well, if you're in that sweet spot of that age group, which is why I asked you earlier about where you were from and your age, because I look at this and my gateway band was, my real gateway band was Raspberries. That was the first rock I ever heard. But the thing that set me totally on my path was Kiss. And for a couple of years, nothing existed in my world as a kid than Kiss. And then the first band I let in that wasn't Kiss and the first poster that ever went on my wall that wasn't Kiss was Aerosmith. So, you would find, I would think, for people in their 50s, a connector to all of these bands in some way. Maybe not stars so much because they weren't commercially successful, but the other bands. And along those lines, when it comes to stars, you sort of make the allegation in the book, and others do as well, that the lack of commercial success for stars could have also been attributed to Kiss in some ways being jealous because a coin was managing another act. Talk a little about that, if you will.
Paul actually says in his book, which I really love that book. He says in the book that KISS were not happy with the fact that O'Coin had these other bands on the roster, bands like Piper, Piper and New England and bands like that. And he felt that O'Coin was just like slapping a logo on a band and putting them out there. And he felt that especially with Stars. And that's what he told me when I spoke with him. So it did seem like there was a little bit of ego involved. They didn't want to have, you know, this band that was on their roster that were actually really, really good. And they were great musicians writing great songs. Maybe they didn't want the competition.
And I never realized until I saw the photos, and I never put this together until I read your book as well, that early on, Stars, you have that photo of Stars in the one show they ever opened for KISS, and they're wearing what was be sort of KISS-like clothing without the makeup. Like, I never put that together, that back then they had some choreography by the same guy, Sean Delaney. There was a wardrobe that was very similar to them. I never realized that. That was maybe one of my biggest revelations in reading your book, that there was that similarity from the bands. And when you think about it, coming out of the same management company, working with the same people, I never saw that angle before until your book.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, before they became Stars, the transition band between Looking Glass and Stars was a band called Fallen Angels. And Fallen Angels actually opened for KISS as well around 9 months before that show in Ohio. They opened for them at the Tower Theater in Philly. And that's when Fallen Angels had none of the costuming or stage presentation that Stars eventually had. Fallen Angels were out there with, you know, their jeans and their, you know, their street clothes. So it's an interesting leap. Only a few months after that, they you know, were sharing the stage with KISS, looking a little bit like KISS.
So, Doug, here's what we're going to do. So Richie Rano from Stars is actually on hold, and I want to bring him into the conversation in our remaining minutes. But and this wasn't planned, by the way. Richie, like I said, is a friend and is listening, and he's been on hold. But I want to ask you one last question before we bring Richie in for the final segment. Of these four bands, you already mentioned Cheap Trick, I guess you feel like is sort of your favorite. But give me your favorite album from each of the four bands.
Favorite album from each of the four bands, KISS, Love Gun, Cheap Trick, Heaven Tonight, Stars, Violation, Aerosmith Rocks.
I'm with you on Stars. I'm with you on Aerosmith. That's surprising on Love Gun from you. I'm interested. I could do a whole hour on that record with you.
I love that record. I don't know. I mean, it has my favorite KISS song, Shock Me, on it. So how could I not love the album?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I don't dislike the record. I would favor Rock and Roll Over. I'd go one album before if I had a pick there. But yeah, it's you know, you can't go wrong with any of that stuff. And again, I love... You got into like you talk about Unmasked in the record. Like, I can remember the day I got Unmasked, and I have so many thoughts on Unmasked alone. I could do hours on it. So it's just, I'm just bringing this up because I want the audience to know that you really do get deep into all of this stuff. And I know my audience is way into getting deep into this. It's just an amazing job.
Thank you.
We have right now joining us, who has been listening, and we've talked about his band quite a bit, from the band Stars, the great Richie Rano. Richie.
Hey, Eddie, they don't talk to me either, by the way.
Well, that's documented.
I'm not naming names.
That's not, well, it's the same guy, I'm sure, but that's documented in your book, because Doug does get into the whole thing about the KISS expos you put on, and how you bought that warehouse and the reason you had to buy the warehouse. I mean, Richie, I've known you forever, but I never knew all that story.
Well, it was a secret till now.
Well, it's in print now. Richie, I want to ask you this. like I was talking about with Doug, and even when Doug approached me and was nice enough to include some words from me in the book, I'm curious about, because I you know I love you, and you know I love your band, but when he said those three bands, and then he said Stars, I'm like, well, wait a minute, where is the connection? And now I understand the connection. Since Doug's book has been out, how has it impacted your band? Have you heard from a lot of people that are either remembering the band or revisiting the band or wanting to learn about the band now?
You know, we noticed that a lot more people are picking up on the band page on Facebook, the Stars band page. And there's actually more than, there's three band pages up there, I guess, by fans and stuff, and one by us. But, yeah, people are interested in the band. Actually, yesterday I saw this thing on from Classic Rock Magazine. They picked the top 10 essential album, AOR albums from the 70s, and Violations in there, one of the 10. So I don't know if that has anything to do with the book, but hey, Doug, it was great that you included us in it. I love all three of those bands myself, and it's, you know, I appreciate it. You did a great job on the book. I read it right away.
Well, thank you. You know, I love the band. Feelings mutual.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank
so,
you.
Well, Richie,
welcome to Rano Nation.
Exactly. Richie's taking over. So, Richie, tell me about, obviously, your band, you were, for people that don't know, Stars is still active. As Doug said earlier, you were going to go out and do a run of dates, and obviously nobody is touring right now and hasn't for a while, but what is the status of the band?
By the way, anyway, I have a gig tonight. If you want to pick the set list out, I'll play every song that you have on it. I'm playing solo, though, so it's got to be all acoustic songs.
So tell everybody about where the band is at now, and do you think when this whole thing is over, will you be able to get out there and maybe even capitalize a little bit off of people talking about the band again, maybe due to this book?
Well, you know, it's funny, when we knew it was coming up and getting ready to come out, and we had like 20 gigs last year around the country, which was a nice amount of gigs for us. We thought that maybe the pre-publicity for it might help us out. And then the following year, being this year, it could really give us a lot more, awareness and stuff. But now, I mean, you'd have to be, some kind of clairvoyant to know what's going to happen in the future. I have no idea what's going to happen now, you know. So I might just do a solo acoustic tour of Stars.
Having read the book, we had talked on text a little bit recently, and I'm curious your thoughts on how Stars comes off in the book and maybe what some of the other people and bands said about you in the book.
Well, it's obvious that these other people still hate us, and that's fine. We were the most probably most hated band ever by other bands.
Come on.
I don't necessarily know why that is. I mean, Aerosmith, the reason that Jack Douglas was our producer was because I loved Get Your Wings so much, I had to find out who produced it. And then I said, this guy's like some kind of genius, and I love him, you know. So when we got our deal a couple of years later, I recommended Jack, and nobody really even knew who he was, but then researched him, and we got him. And so I loved all three bands. I mean, Cheap Trick, I think I was at their very first gig, if I'm not mistaken, in Madison, Wisconsin. I was hanging out there for a while. And Kiss, the first album, I still think is their best album.
Do you think it's fair, the comparisons that people made to Kiss? Do you see it at all? I never picked up on it till Doug's book, and Paul Stanley has some comments about you guys in it. What are your thoughts about that, and did you feel like that back in 76 when you were working with Aquin?
Well, the thing was, Sean was working with us, and he said, you know, you got to make some big moves, and you're going to be playing arenas right off the bat. And he had some valid points. And then they had a costume maker who made the costumes for Kiss, making the costumes for us, because we didn't want to go out. I was wearing costumes already for 4 years or so in bands, because I was big into Ziggy Stardust and David Bowie. So it's not like we just suddenly like flicked a switch and said, let's try this, which is what people seem to think we did. It's not that. We were already, all five of us were into that kind of stuff already. But we had the ability to get these people involved, like the people who made Kiss's costumes. So, yeah, so there were some similarities, and we quickly ditched it by the second album. We didn't wear the high boots and stuff, which I wore when I was in Stories. So, I mean, it's not like I had that crazy suit that Ace wore in Kiss before he ever had one like that, you know, with the silver stuff that goes around it. When I was in Stories, I wore it. It's whatever, you know, they want to take you down. You know, people want to take you down. They don't want to build you up. Let's be honest.
Did you feel that way back then when the band was starting too? Did you feel that people felt that way about Stars then, for the public perception or even people in the industry?
No, I don't think the public perception was quite to that degree. I think the problem that we had was all the promoters hated Kiss and all the other bands hated Kiss. Not us, but the other bands did. They resented them, just as Doug pointed out. And the promoters hated them because of the demands they would make. So we had every band that we played with. When we played with Aerosmith, they instantly hated us because of Kiss. And, you know, we had to try to get friendly with them. In some cases we did, and some bands we didn't. Blue Oyster Cult, I only got to be friends with them in the last, you know, 15 years. They always hated us. But it was like we inherited the hatred for Kiss, unfortunately. So we really did start off in a hole, in a sense. It was kind of weird. We thought it would be good to be associated with Kiss, but it really wasn't. It was definitely not good.
And there's one really interesting moment in the book where Doug asks you, I guess, one reason why Stars didn't quote-unquote make it, and you point out directly one guy who's a very influential guy in the history of rock radio, and that's Lee Abrams, who's a consultant, and you say that he was basically, you know, he basically didn't put Stars on the list of bands that should be played.
It's exactly right. So when we go play San Antonio, for example, we pack places, we play festivals there. Why? Because our records continue to be played there from 1980 on. But from 1980 on, around most of the country, radio stations stopped playing us. Cleveland continued, a few handful of cities did, but everyone else went over this with Lee Abrams, AOR. What was that thing? What did they call it? Classic rock radio, I guess, right?
Superstars, according to the book, right,
Superstars,
Doug?
Yeah, Superstars, okay. Format. Yeah.
Obviously, he didn't like us, and he says that's not the case, but you have a hard time fooling me.
Yeah, that's interesting, too, that you mentioned Texas, because I took a call from a listener last week when I was talking about Stars, and he was in Texas, and he said, I think in San Antonio, to this day, they play Coliseum Rock constantly, and it's like it was a big thing there.
Yes, Coliseum Rock in particular, but they do play other songs, obviously, and that's what it's all about. It's about feeding people music, and then that music continues. The Journey wasn't the biggest band of the 70s. People make it out to be, but they weren't. But they got into that classic rock thing of constant, over and over playing on those classic rock stations. And I love Journey, by the way. I love so many different bands. I'm not a negative guy when it comes to listening to other bands. I'm a big fan of music, you know. And some people have too big of an ego to really be, and when they're musicians making albums, they have too big of an ego to like another band. It's weird, right? But I'm not like that. So anyway, I don't know. I got off the track. Sorry.
Well, that's right. I actually have to wrap up here anyway, because they're going to cut me if I don't end to time. So, Doug, congrats on the book. Well, I'm sure we could do this again somewhere down the line, because it's endless, the stuff that's in it. And I want to remind everybody to go pick it up. Well, I really enjoyed that conversation with Doug and really, really enjoyed his book. And it's great revisiting that era of rock music, which really is probably my favorite as far as all the decades of rock that I like. The 70s stuff I still just love so much, and I cannot recommend the book more highly. And thanks to Richie Rano, a little surprise check-in and call-in joining us there at the end. And was great to include him as well. I'm serious. It would be awesome to do a roundtable with a member from each of those four bands. And I also was serious about what I said about Doug and loving to see him write a book about those other bands I mentioned, the obscure 70s hard rock bands. I could do a whole book just on that. All right. I appreciate you guys listening, of course, and I thank you for doing so. Spread the word. Be sure to subscribe, favorite, all that good stuff that you do with the podcast. I know there's a ton of them out there these days, but I appreciate you checking out mine and making it a part of your listening. And again, what you just heard originated on my SiriusXM radio show, and I hope you check that out every day if you're in the U.S. or Canada. And you're only getting a tiny sample here on the podcast, but you can hear me daily, 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on 106 Volume and nightly replays of that show, 10 to midnight Eastern, or you can just go on the SiriusXM app and listen whenever you want. Have yourself a great rest of the week, everybody. I'll catch you next Thursday for another all-new episode of the Eddie Trunk Podcast, which is produced by Katie Irizarry at Eddie Trunk on social media. Have a good week.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.